Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you doing, man?
I'm very good.
Excellent shirt.
Yes.
So we're continuing on your journey across the company to meet devs.
And today we're meeting another Eric, but of course his name is not spelled as beautiful as mine.
Okay.
Although he will say exactly the opposite. Ah. So this is Eric Lippert. I guess most Niners know him from his blogs and everything. And from his work on the C# compiler, and before that on JavaScript and so on. So I think this will be a very interesting conversation today.
Absolutely.
So Eric, the first thing that I ask in many of these interviews in this series, like, how did you become a computer scientist? What is your first contact with computers or programming?
Let's see, I started programming computers before I owned a computer, actually. I was always fascinated by programming computers as soon as I realized that there was such a thing. I remember using the Commodore PET in my school library to write programs that would animate little rocket ships flying around the screen, and I had a book, which I think I may even still have on my bookshelf here. There it is right there. Practice your basic. Everybody, practice your basic.
Nice. That's amazing. It's like, I think the vast majority of the people that we talk to started with basic.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic. So that was your school computer?
That was my school computer, and I got a Commodore 64 shortly after that and started programming that. The first program of any size that I wrote that I was really proud of was a little window manager for the Commodore 64 that would use the little box drawing characters to animate the windows getting bigger and smaller. That was very exciting to me.
He's very serious. You know what my first program was for the Commodore 64? That was in the dorm to keep track of the beer consumption.
Excellent. Nice.
But yeah, that was Commodore 64 as well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we also had a program, not for beer consumption, but my friends would get together every week and watch horror movies, and we had a program that would keep track of who had paid for gas and who had paid for the movie and who had paid for the popcorn and stuff like that, so that when people were freeloading, we could detect that and cut them off. So,
nice.
Yeah,
yes.
we were using computers to solve non-technical problems very early.
Yes, exactly. And these days, you know, you would write an app for that, right?
So, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I bet there is an app for it.
There probably
there's plenty,
is, yeah.
There's lots of apps for those things, yes. So then you got fascinated by computers. Where did you go to college?
I went to the University of Waterloo. I got a BMath in...
So you're Canadian.
I am Canadian, yeah. I actually grew up in Waterloo.
Nice.
And I have, you know, relatives who worked at the university and whatnot, so it was very natural for me to go there. You know, I already knew a lot of the staff and the faculty, and it was a great program. They have a cooperative education program at Waterloo, so you go to school for, you know, 4 years, 8 months a year, and you work for 2 years in total, six work terms, four months each, and... So by the end of it, you spend 5 years getting a 4-year degree, and you end up with 2 years of work experience. And I came out of school, you know, with a job waiting for me here, and no debt, and already, you know, knowing what both the theory and the practice of writing code was like. So yeah, that was a really valuable experience for me.
And so when you joined Microsoft right out of college?
Yeah.
And so where was your first job? What was your first group?
Well, I've been in the same group essentially the entire time. When I was an intern, when I was a Waterloo intern here, I worked on Visual Basic for Applications. And then when I started full-time, I worked on VBScript and JScript, which was an offshoot of that team. And then that project ended, and I worked on Visual Studio Tools for Office for a while. And then worked on the C# team where I am now. So I've been in the developer division the whole time.
All right, and so it's kind of interesting that, you know, when you worked on JavaScript, I think that was like in the 1990s. That was like its heyday, and
yes.
Then you know it kind of, you know, and now it's all back again, and dynamic languages, etc. So And as we all know, in C# Trio, there's support for dynamic in the language.
Yeah, in C# 4.
C# 4.
Right.
As well, off by one error. I start counting at zero. So
there you go.
So can you explain what were the challenges to implement that in the compiler?
The dynamic feature in C# 4, it was not personally my feature, but I was at the design meetings and helped out with its implementation and whatnot. And there were a lot of challenges with that thing. There were both the sort of technical challenges of how do we make it fast, and the DLR team did the heavy lifting there. They really gave us a solid infrastructure for making dynamic code perform as well as can be expected. From a language design point of view, we have this big language, right? We have this...
Yes, look at this. Compare that. That is scary. Look at that.
Yeah. Programming the good stuff and then the C# program.
Yeah, we have this 800-page specification, and somehow we had to figure out every possible interaction of dynamic with... every possible, expression, statement, everything.
Overloading.
But, the meetings on overload resolution alone. Dozens and dozens of meetings about that. And coming up with the weirdest corner cases of, what happens if we have a static method and this argument is, and it's an extension method, and this argument is statically known, and this one is not, this one's dynamic, and this is a list of dynamic, blah, 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 blah. Those were difficult design decisions, and no design decisions are easy, right? Every design decision is a process of taking a whole bunch of things that are mutually incompatible and deciding which ones are more important, which ones can give, which ones can't, and trying to reach a decent compromise, right? So that was a very long process. Actually, writing the code, once you've made all the design decisions, is not that hard. Right, as long as the decisions are crisp and well documented, it's making the decisions that is really where that sausage is made. They always say you don't want to see the inside of a sausage factory. Well, you don't want to see the insides of the C# design meetings when we've got whiteboards completely covered with crazy overload resolution cases.
Yes, but on the other hand, I must say, I think the C# design team is one of the most efficient sausage factories that I know, and they make one of the most tasteful sausages in programming language land. So can you explain a little bit for the Niners how the C# design process goes? And how you meet and how long you meet and how that...
Right. So we used to have three design meetings a week, 2 hours each. And we've cut back on that a little bit.
And those dated back to the way in the beginning, 98 or something, when C# was started?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, we have a design note archive that goes all the way back to the late 90s, yeah. And for a long time, for I think the first 6 or 7 years, it was in the same room every single time.
We spent many beautiful hours there.
Yeah, yeah, that was before my time. We stopped using that room shortly after, I guess a couple years after I joined the team, because we started getting people who were working remotely, right? Like Neil Gafter joined the team. And he was spending a lot of his time in California, and we needed a room that had the right AV equipment so that we could, get his face up on the screen and whatnot. But yeah, we've cut back the number of hours a week because we have kind of split our efforts into two efforts. We have the async await group, and then we have a sort of a longer lead group that's codenamed Roslyn. That's the one I'm working on. And that's trying to figure out how to re-architect the compiler so that we can open up some of the internals of the compiler as a service that that developers can use. So we now have one design meeting a week that's just for sort of core C# language issues, and one design meeting that is, or two design meetings a week that are more for the longer lead looking forward stuff. But still, it's essentially, the same meeting and the same people on a lot of the same issues. So we get together, three times a week, and usually in the room are people like Anders Mads Torgersen, who's the the C-sharp specification lead, and a bunch of other people, you know, Neil Gafter and Matt Warren, and Peter Goldie is back on the team now. So a bunch of senior architect people, and occasionally me and other people from around the company, you know, like yourself, you know, who drops by occasionally. And we'll have an agenda, and we will discuss, you know, some aspect of the language, you know, and it'll be how should async work with IEnumerable, right, was one that we discussed recently. And there's a lot of back and forth on that, you know, should it be a fine-grained feature, should it be a coarsely-grained feature, should, you know, if you're fetching a bunch of bytes asynchronously, should you be awaiting each byte? Should you be awaiting a chunk of 10,000 bytes and then parceling them out from there? How is that mm-hmm. going to work? And, you know, like I said before, it's a process of compromise. Everybody has different opinions, and we try to figure out what's the compromise that best serves the customer.
So, and one of the things you mentioned is that there's, like, design meeting notes that kind of, you know, date back for a long time. And mm-hmm. so every meeting, you know, they're... notes are made for the meeting, mm-hmm. And so how do you then coordinate between what's discussed in the design meeting and what, you know, your day job where you have mm-hmm. to implement, you know, what is being designed in the design meetings?
You know, developers often complain about process. You know, the imposition of some you know, management control over your day-to-day work. And this is an area where I actually wish we had a little bit more process, because there are several times when things have kind of fallen through the cracks, right, where I've proposed a change to the type inference specification, and we've agreed on the change to the type inference specification, but for some reason, you know, it's... we never actually edit the line of the spec that we need to, right? Or the opposite happens, we edit the line of the spec, but the code never gets changed, right? Or you think you're bringing the spec and the code in line with each other, and in fact, they're subtly mismatched, right? Or the code implements the right thing, but the layout of the code is so different from the layout of the spec that you can't tell that it does, right? And you have to rely on testing. I have been, you know, trying over many years to make the structure of bits of the compiler read more like, you know, specific lines of the specification. And I will often take big paragraphs of the specification, put them into point form, put them in the source code as comments, and then write the code so that it just goes right down that list of the events.
Yes, and that is quite interesting because you have quite a lot of blog posts where you discuss these kind of little discrepancies between, you know, what is maybe in the spec and what's implemented. For example, one that I found very fascinating is when you were talking about constants and compile time evaluation. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure. In fact, this is the second time this has come up in the last hour. Somebody asked me about that when I was in the kitchen getting a cup of tea right before we started this interview. The issue there was this was a problem that we had in when I started working on C# 3. The compiler in C# 2. Suppose you had something like should I write on the whiteboard?
Yep, sure.
Yeah. Suppose you had something like. Int x equals 10, and then you had something really strange, like if x times 0 equals 0, then maybe we've got an int y here as well. Y equals 1, 2, 3, right? Now, and then maybe down here you've got a console write line y. Okay. So, is this legal? Well, in C# 2, the compiler reasoned as follows. X is definitely assigned to be 10. X is an integer. If, okay, we've got an integer times 0, we know that's always going to be 0, mm-hmm. right? We know that this usage of a local variable never has a side effect, therefore we can optimize this away to be 0. 0 equals 0, we know that's always true, so we can optimize that away to be true. Now we have if true, so we can optimize this away. Okay, now we have int y, x equals 10, y equals... So this is legal, right? That's not what the spec says, right? The spec says that for the purposes of determining whether a variable is definitely assigned, you only reason about compile time constants. And because this contains a variable,
yes.
It is by definition not a constant, even though you and I both know that it will always be true. Right? Hmm. So we actually took a breaking change for this. I fixed the code so that it matched the spec. And anybody who had crazy code like this, who we hope was nobody, would then break. And we think we only broke our own test cases, you know, which is good. But it's just things like that where, you know, the person who wrote that code thought they were doing the right thing, and in a very real sense they were. I mean, they were implementing a, in one sense, correct analysis of the program. It just wasn't correct according to the spec. Hmm. And we decided to fix that because, you know, consider something like, you know, suppose you have a lambda, mm-hmm. and you have something like x times 0, right? Do you want this lambda, suppose this lambda is being converted to an expression tree,
okay.
right? Do you want that to be converted to the expression tree 0 or the expression tree multiply x by 0, right? It seems pretty clear that if you're asking for this to be converted to an expression tree, you would like to know what's the expression, you know, the fact that it was a multiplication. We don't want to optimize this away, right? So we removed that optimization, we took the breaking change. Now, the optimization is still there, right? We just moved the optimization to happen right before code generation, right? So we generate the same code now, right? You know, in fact, we do optimize away the if, right, if we were to make this a legal program. So there's no hit in the efficiency. We just brought the code more into line with the spec.
Yes, and this is also like an interesting thing where you kind of, you know, would discuss the design, because what if you write a lambda expression of 5 times 3?
Right.
Maybe, you know, you want to see that as a multiplication too, instead of, optimizing
that.
Yes.
Yeah. And we debated that, and what we decided was that in that case, you actually want the constant 15, right? You want the compiler to do the work to say, okay, I know I can simplify this expression because it's all constants, right? But we actually considered doing it the other way, and I wrote a bunch of gear in the compiler so that if we ever changed our minds, we could just flip a switch and it would start to work that way. Because I was concerned that there was going to be some last-minute design meeting where somebody had some crazy scenario where, oh, we have to have this multiplication preserved for this translation from link to SQL, blah, 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 blah. So all that gear is still in the compiler somewhere.
And so you said that you're trying to structure your code to mimic the language spec.
Yes.
So what about tests, the compiler tests? Are they following the language specification as well? Or do you have a certain structure in there as well?
We have lots and lots of tests. We have millions and millions of lines of tests. And there is one set of tests that our test team maintains that's just called the conformance tests. And, yeah, they've just gone through the spec, and they try to have one test for every little bit of the spec. They go through our complete list of error messages. They try to have multiple tests that confirm that every error message is producible, and what kind of code produces that error, you know, and so on. When I'm doing sort of check-in tests, to verify my own work, I tend to do more white box testing where I look at the code and I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to figure out, you know, what are the test cases that exercise this line of code and this line of code and this line of code, and what are the strange cases that I had to consider, and try to make sure that there's a test for each of those. We also have code coverage tests that testers regularly run coverage analysis, and they point out, oh, you don't have a test that covers this block. You know, please go write one.
And so what kind of tools do you use for tests? What kind of test frameworks do you use?
We have an unit, I think is the name of the package. It's integrated into Visual Studio, and essentially we just have the code project, and we have a test project beside it that can see the internals of the code project. And you can just right-click on that thing and say, run all of the tests, and it just runs them and reports which ones passed and which ones failed. And it's very straightforward. The you know, that's for the developers. The QA team has their own huge set of tools, and I don't know how any of them work.
And so like when you look at the compiler, we now talked about the compiler itself, but of course the language itself is much more than the compiler. There's also the Visual Studio integration, IntelliSense, yes. Syntax highlighting. Can you explain a little bit how, you know, these things all relate, and maybe also like how much code, you know, is like, is the compiler only a tiny fraction of the whole C-sharp product?
I wouldn't say that it's a tiny fraction, but the idea that a compiler is something that takes in source code and spits out object code, that is long gone, yeah. Right? We are way beyond that. In the past, like in the C-sharp 1 and 2 eras, there were essentially two silos, right? There was the compiler, and there was the IDE, right? And they shared a lexer and a parser, and that was it, right? The compiler team had their own semantic analyzer and, you know, error reporting mechanisms and stuff like that, and the IDE had their own semantic analyzer that had different error recovery heuristics. And a lot of the time they agreed, and some of the time they didn't, which was sometimes a good thing, you know, because you want your IDE experience to be snappy, right? Yep. You want that analysis to be extremely fast. When you press that dot, you want a list of the stuff that's available, and if there are, if there's some obscure error about the accessibility of this thing, blah 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 blah, work it out later, right? You know, when you build, you'll find the error. That turned out to not scale very well. And when we got to C# 3, we realized, oh god, we're adding extension methods and lambdas and query comprehensions and this and that and the other thing. A huge amount of new features in the semantic analysis. And nobody wanted to do that stuff twice. So we decided to work on getting the IDE and the compiler's semantic analysis engines kind of merged together, so that the IDE would be more consuming the compiler's semantic analysis rather than doing their own. And that worked very well. It was a big risk and it was a big investment, but it worked out. Now, something that we realized in doing that was the compiler is producing all of this very rich information about the code. You know, it knows everything, you know, lexically about the code. It knows everything syntactically. It can make good guesses about the types of everything, you know, even if the code's incorrect. It has all kinds of heuristics in it for type inference of incorrect code. And that, you know, we have things like refactoring engines in the IDE, right, where you say, oh, I want to, you know, select this code and hit extract method, right? And that does a lot of stuff. Like, people think extract method is, you know, just take the text over here and put it over. But we do a huge amount of analysis in extract method. You know, we're saying, okay, tell us about all the variables that are assigned, right, that are assigned before they come into this chunk of code, that are assigned after they go out of this chunk of code, right? Did any of those change, right? If they did, if one of them changed, maybe it should be the return value of the function that you're abstracting. If multiple of them changed, maybe there should be out parameters, or maybe some of them should be ref parameters, and so on. Right? All of this analysis that goes on. And because the interface between the compiler and the IDE is extremely, you know, ad hoc and hard to understand, and, you know, built by experts who are, you know, in each other's code all day long, every day, that there was really no way for customers to use this thing. So that's kind of what motivated the whole Roslyn project, was we already have a compiler that is proffering up a code analysis service to one client. Can we find some way to make that analysis available in general, right, to the general public? Because you look around Microsoft, and the number of different teams that have written their own C# parsers is large, mm-hmm. right? even just parsers, right? People who want to be able to take C# in and then transform it into some other language, for example, right? Or do syntax coloring or whatever, right? For because they've got a little dev environment. And even if they don't want to compile anything because it's going to be compiled somewhere else, they want to do syntax coloring. Just stuff like that. Lots and lots of teams have written their own parsers, and most of them are wrong, right? You know, and they don't have to be perfect, because most of them aren't generating code. But it would be nice if they were all the same, you know. And it seems like a big waste of effort to have a dozen different teams doing essentially the same work when we have a team that is already an expert on the C#, you know, the C# grammar and its analysis. So that's what we've been working on for a while now.
Cool.
Yeah.
And so another thing you mentioned, you know, that you're like there's a lot of work in doing the type inference and type checking. Mm. So when you added dynamic to C#, some of that checking is kind of deferred until runtime, where you have to do the overload resolution. Are you using the same code at runtime as you use at compile time for that, or is there a different runtime system?
What we did in C# 4 was we took the... So first of all, you're absolutely right. We have to do all of the analysis that we were going to do at compile time and do it at runtime, right? So how are we going to do that? What we did was we took the C# 4 compiler, which was written in C++. We extracted from it the portions of the semantic analyzer that were necessary to do all of the tasks that dynamic needs to do, right? So you don't need to worry about any statements, for example. But you do need to worry about all of the expressions, you know, addition and subtraction and multiplication and method calls and member access and, you know, all of that stuff. So we pulled all of that code out, and we did a line-for-line translation of that into non-idiomatic C#, right? It just looks like C++ written in C#. And then cleaned that up so that it was, you know, somewhat like well-written C# and efficient, and shipped that, right? So when you call a dynamic expression, what happens is the compiler spits out code that says, here's enough information for you to analyze at runtime, right? And then at runtime, the DLR says, oh, I see that this thing is a C# expression. Let me hand it off to the C# expression analyzer. Right? And that thing then says, oh, well, I see that the type of this thing is blah, blah, blah. Let me run the type analysis, you know. Mm-hmm. And it spits out the same error messages that the C# 4 compiler would have and everything, right? All of the things that used to be error messages are now exceptions. And we're good to go. Now, going forward, it is not clear whether we are going to continue to use that piece of code, which, after all, works, right? It's not a good idea to throw away working code that's already debugged, and just make, you know, the updates for it that are necessary to make any features that we would add in the future version of C# work, or whether we will say, oh, you know what, we have this compiler as a service thing now, let's start using it for dynamic. That decision has yet to be made. We are trying to design the compiler as a service stuff so as to not preclude that scenario unnecessarily, but we're also not saying that it is a must-have. So that decision will be made later.
Okay. And when we're talking about the compiler as a service, how did you go about to write that? Did you start from scratch, or did you take the existing compiler and refactor that?
Oh, we did both. No, it was a long process of deciding how to do it, and there were a couple of false starts, actually. We had multiple people working on prototypes because we weren't sure what the best approach was.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I am kind of more of the, I know we have something that works, let's take that thing, translate it, keep it working, improve it. But the problem with that approach is that you tend to take something that, you know, is towards the end of its lifetime and having, you know, a lot of sort of architectural problems, and then you port it into a new language, and now you have something that has architectural problems and isn't performance-tuned to be in the new language, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and other people pointed out, well, you know, we have, you know, experts, and we have a body of code that we know works. Let's write something from scratch, you know, where I use the term advisedly, taking the parts that we can reuse easily and building, you know, but building a fundamentally new architecture, right? So that's really what we're doing. We are strongly embracing a more functional style than the previous C# compiler had. Where by a functional style, I mean we tend to operate on immutable data structures where we say, okay, we have the parse tree and we will never change this thing, right? When somebody hits a key in the IDE and we need to reparse something, we will figure out how much of that previous parse tree can we reuse because effectively nothing changed, right? And can we just recompute these little bits? So you think about, you know, adding a new letter in the middle of an identifier doesn't change anything about the parse tree except for the specific characters in that identifier, right? Now, adding a character to the middle of identifier could completely change the semantic analysis, mm-hmm. right? It could utterly change the semantic analysis. So that we tend to rebuild on an as-needed basis. But all of the stuff that we're doing is really based on, you know, immutable trees, facade patterns. We have a lot of you know, builder pattern kind of things. A lot of visitors. It's a very functionally oriented way of writing a compiler, considering we're doing it in what's effectively an object-oriented language.
Hmm. So when you contrast that with the old compiler, how do you represent the parse trees there? And is that all very mutable? And
the old compiler, the parse trees tended to be fairly immutable. We don't mess around with them too much, but the trees that represented the sort of the bound state, you know, the parse tree plus all of the type annotations that we've done in the semantic analysis, were highly mutable. Right, we would be constantly going through there and saying, "Oh, I know that that this symbol has been read. Right, let me set a bit on that. Oh, I know that this symbol has been written to. Let me set a bit on that. Right, and then we do another pass and says, were there any symbols that were read that weren't written? Right, so we can give a warning for that. You know, that kind of thing. So, lots and lots of mutations where the mutations introduced by one phase of compilation would then be consumed by future phases of compilation, and it made it fast. Right, but it made it tricky to reason about the code because you'd be looking at the code in the debugger and you'd think, I have all of these fields here on this symbol, you know, the blah 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 blah. Which of those are correct, and which of those have just not been set yet? And you know, which of them are going to be, you know, maybe changed later, and where are they going to be changed, and how can I tell? You know, so. The immutable model, it makes it much easier to reason about the code, which is something I really like. But you know that when you're looking at a thing, it's going to stay the same, right? And it better be right.
So you mentioned that you're using a lot of visitors and so on. So one of the things that, in my experience, when you're first going from like an imperative style with lots of updates to a more functional style, that there's often, you know, it takes some time to find a new balance. You know, you can go all the way overboard with lambdas and passing them around. Did you experience that kind of same, you know, where you maybe overshoot a little bit too far?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, we're definitely going through growing pains on this whole thing and trying to figure out what is the right balance. Because sometimes you really do want to say, you know what, we have more information now after this analysis than we did before. The symbols, you know, haven't changed. We have all the same, you know, classes and parameters and events and properties and whatnot that we did before. We just have more information about them. Why don't we just update those objects? Right? And so, you know, it's a process of figuring out what's the right compromise between, you know, the ease of understanding and clarity and performance and all of those things. And yeah, it's very easy to go overboard with functional programming and write programs that are clever and powerful, and so clever and powerful that you don't understand them.
Yes.
Right? And that's specifically what I want to avoid. I want the compiler code to be very straightforward. Like I said, I want you to be able to just like kind of run down the spec and say, okay, it's doing everything that's in the spec.
Yeah, and that's the hardest thing to do, right? To write stupid code.
I mean, yes.
that sounds strange, but it's easy to write really complicated code. That you know, but sure. to write code that somebody else can maintain, mm-hmm. And that's easy to understand and easy to read. That is a tough job.
So one question I would have is, why would you use a non-functional language, even though C# has the kind of the lambdas and stuff that you guys added? Why not just use F#? It's easier said than done.
Sure.
I'm just curious.
Sure.
Why? What's the big deal of like throwing away C++, which you're doing because it was old? C++ is always going to be faster than C#.
Well, okay.
But anyway,
I'm not sure that Charles.
Let's talk. No, I don't want. This isn't about Charles. This is not the name of Charles. Nobody would watch that. So, but in some sense, the real question I want to ask you is: we don't have to do the C++ thing. I'm not going to argue with you. You're going to win. All right. So, the question I would ask is: why wouldn't you just use a functional language to take care of to solve your functional problems instead of trying to shoehorn one that's sort of awkward?
Yeah. You know, that's a great question. And, you know, the F# compiler is written in F#.
Yes.
And the F# team tells me that it is a great language to write a compiler, right?
And some people will say that the only use of a functional language is to write compilers. That's what they say about Haskell, right? The only Haskell program is the Haskell compiler.
Yeah. And, you know, personally, I would love to write a C# compiler or any compiler in a more functional language like F#. Part of the reason is simple practicality. You know, we have, the half a dozen, eight people on this team who are in the code every day, and all of them are C# experts. Mm. Every single one of them, right? None of them are F# experts, right? Mm. So, you know, we could become F# experts, right? But that's going to take time. Right, I haven't written any OCaml since I was in university, and that was a while ago now. Right,
fair enough.
Yeah,
but you're a C++ developer.
Sure.
And that's a great language for writing compilers. I mean, the C++ compiler front end and back end are both written in C++.
Sure. And we strongly considered writing the compiler, either continuing to write it in C++, or writing it in C++ CLI. And we finally decided on C# because we wanted it to be a managed language, right? Because we want to lower the sort of mismatch between the code that is producing the type information for compiler as a service and the code that's consuming it. The code that's consuming it is probably going to be written in C# or VB, right? Mm-hmm. Or some other managed language, right? Almost certainly, right? We didn't want to write something in native C++ and then have some big, complicated marshaling layer that would get to move it across the managed, unmanaged boundary, blah, blah, blah. I've written a lot of code like that. It's painful to write. And it felt like we would be making a big investment in writing a lot of glue for an architecture that was towards the end of its lifespan. Mm. Right? We figured this is our opportunity. We are all experts on C++, or we're all experts on C#. Mm-hmm. Let's write something that is, that has a good balance of being object-oriented while using functional language.
Fair enough.
Plus,
there's
something immensely beautiful about a compiler written in its own language. Sure. I mean, that's just magical, right? Bootstrapping the compiler. And in some sense, that's long overdue with C#.
Yes. Yes, and major portions of the... we're doing all the same thing in VB, too. Like, I'm concentrating on C# because that's what I work on personally. Mm-hmm. But the C# and VB teams are the same team now, right? And big portions of the VB compiler are being written in VB.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right, so back to your regularly scheduled program. But I thought that was interesting. So I just want to make one thing, though. When he says architectural changes, it has nothing to do with C++. It's the architecture of the compiler.
Yeah.
Just to make that crystal clear for everybody out there.
Yeah. But I do believe that it is a good idea to write the compiler of your language in your own language, because often as a, if you're a language, a compiler writer, you do get a better feeling from your, you know, when you're using your own language, you know, about all the features. And since, you know, like Eric is probably spending, you know, most of his days writing the compiler, you know, that is where you have your most muscles in that language. So I think it's good to learning to write the compiler in the language itself.
I mean, there's this whole idea of eating your own dog food, right? And this is a great example of eating your own dog food. You really figure out what the irritating corner cases of a language are when you've got to write a, not only a compiler, but a fast compiler in that language. And we're finding out all kinds of things.
And so are there things that, you know, you would kind of wish that were in C#, you know, to write the compiler easier or faster?
Yes. Yes, there are definitely things that I, you know, that... that I wish were in C#, but I don't want to necessarily push for them to be, you know, I don't want to use my position to try and say, oh, we really need this feature for C# because it would make my life easier.
Yeah. Right?
Because this is a tool for everybody, not just for compiler developers, right? But yeah, there are plenty of things that I would like to have in C#. Like, you know, because we're going with a more immutable object model, I wish we had more tools to say, this field is read-only, and I'm going to set it here, and I know that it's set, right? We have syntax for that, but it's kind of clunky, right? It could be very tight. It could be very small. You know, I look at the syntax for, you know, for Haskell, for example, you know, that, that you're an expert in, and you know, the way that you declare these data structures is so concise, right? And the way that you declare similar immutable, you know, persistent data structures in C# is so verbose. And I think probably the ideal would be somewhere between the two. You know, I find these little gems of Haskell sometimes hard to read because they are so pared down to their essentials that, that there's so little redundancy to them that that it makes it difficult to extract the information from them. But on
so sometimes, like in Haskell, it's like condensed soup. And then when you consume that, you get a sodium overload.
That is exactly, Yes, I'm totally stealing that. That's exactly how I feel about it. Whereas in C#, there is so much ceremony around things. Oh, I have to say an interface, blah, and then I have a class, oh, it implements this interface, blah, 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 blah. You know, all of this ceremony that convinces the compiler of type facts, you know, type system facts that he could have deduced, right? You know, I wish there were more implicit typing in C#. For example, right? Not a lot more, but just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and are those things that maybe could be like restrictions that could be lifted because you're writing a new compiler that are kind of, you know, slight, you know, not big language changes, but, you know, often certain design decisions are made because of the structure of the compiler, the way you kind of, you know, have the phases in a certain order and so on, that when you're refactoring the compiler, you know, you could remove certain restrictions.
Yeah, we are considering that. You know, for example, there are certain restrictions about how nested types and how nested types may inherit from other types. And those restrictions were sort of based on the order in which the compiler, the C# 1 and 2 and 3 compilers and 4 compilers had to run through the source code in an order that they could emit it so that the metadata emitter would be efficient, right? Well, we no longer have that problem, right? Because we have a different metadata emitter now, and it has different performance characteristics. So should we change that, should we change those rules so that more programs become legal? And we're still doing it in a you know reasonable performance. That's not clear. You know, we will consider those things on a case by case basis. We are definitely taking this opportunity to say to not be slavishly backwards compatible. Right. So every day I am finding error messages in the new compiler that are different than the error messages in the old compiler. Usually the ones in the new compiler are better. Right, because there was just some small bug, right? Just some small error in the analysis, where we would, for example, one I found the other day was if you put ref on a constant, right, and you try to pass it as an argument. One of the, we give three errors, and one of the errors that we give is missing ref. Right. Well, the reason for that is because, again, the optimizer is looking at that thing and it's saying ref and a constant. That doesn't make any sense. I'm going to throw the ref away and just make it the constant, right? And then some later analyzer comes along and says, I'm expecting this thing to be a ref, but you've got a constant. There's no ref on it, right? And so we give two errors, one of which is dead wrong, right? We're not going to replicate that error, right? We're going to get rid of the one that's wrong. So there's lots of opportunities like that where we can... where maybe it would not have met our bar to go in and start mucking around with this delicate algorithm in the native compiler, but you know we're changing everything, right? So we might as well get it right. Yeah. You know, there's no reason to be strictly backwards compatible with stuff that was wrong to begin with.
And how much of the kind of C-sharp specific features do you use in the compiler? I think about things like link and maybe even the new async feature. Are those things that you kind of use when you write the new compiler?
We are writing the we're compiling the new compiler in C-sharp 4, so we don't get the async stuff. I think it would be kind of nice to do some prototypes where we experiment with the async stuff, because we have opportunities to do things like parallelization of the compiler, right? We could, for example, do an initial pass over everything, generate all the type information, right, for everything but method bodies, and then we could compile all the method bodies in parallel, right? There's no reason why this method body and this method body, they have nothing to do with each other. We already know the types of the method declarations. The bodies are irrelevant, right? They don't affect each other. So we could compile those things in parallel. Should we do that? Should we spawn off a bunch of tasks and await them? Maybe. Maybe that's efficient. Maybe it's not. We'll do some experiments on that. We are using surprisingly little link, which is unfortunate, because when I've written, when we write a lot of prototypes, when I write prototype analyzers, semantic analyzers, the link syntax for them is so concise, right? You know, you just want to be able to write these queries that are like, from, symbol in this set of symbols where the symbol is accessible, blah, 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 projected onto this, etc. We are trying to make the compiler scale to extremely large projects, and part of that means being very careful about collection pressure. Yeah. Right? So every time you allocate memory on the heap, then you're essentially telling the garbage collector, "Hey, maybe you should be collecting soon because I'm using more memory here, and some of that might be short-lived. I might want it back." And a number of the link features do produce collection pressure, right? It's small collection pressure, but it adds up, right? And we are doing huge amounts of analysis over large sets of symbols. And so we're trying to be very thoughtful about our use of link, right? And I don't want that to come across as saying don't use link, it's slow, right? Because it's not. Most of the time, in most applications, the small performance hit is tiny compared to the savings that you get in making the code concise and look like what you want it to, like the business semantics that you want to represent. But in our particular case, where we are really trying hard to be able to scale up to these, many, many thousands of files and many, many, many hundreds of projects, compilation scenarios, it's not your normal, line of business program, right? It's not your normal, active server pages, let's, generate a view of this database table kind of scenario. So, I wish, that we would use more link, and I would like to revisit some of these performance-based decisions, in the future and see if there are places where we can start, taking algorithms that that are quite long, right? Because it's a lot of imperative code, and reduce it to something more declarative.
Yeah, but again, I think that's always the kind of challenge, right? Between efficiency and elegance and conciseness, and that's what makes programming interesting.
Yes.
Because, you know, there's usually, you know, otherwise if the answer would always be clear, right, you know, we would be out on the streets, you know, yeah, without a job.
Yeah.
So another thing there that must, I think, give you some kind of challenge is that you're trying to use the same infrastructure for both VB and C#, where the languages are, you know, not completely the same. The semantics are slightly different. So how do you deal with those differences?
Yeah, that was a point of massive contention for quite a long time. We had multiple meetings a week about what's our strategy going to be for this thing. And we had a bunch of different options, right? One of the options was write a single compiler, mm-hmm, right? Write a compiler that can take VB source code and C# source code, maybe even in the same project, and compile them to the, you know, to the same kind of parse tree, the same kind of semantically bound tree, the same IL, and you're done, right? And another option was two silos, right? Two completely separate compilers that have nothing to do with each other, right? And the third option was something in between. And we, you know, as is often the case, the best decision is somewhere in the middle. And that's what we ended up doing. So because the C# and VB compilers, clearly they generate the same code at the back end, mm-hmm, right? You know, so we're going to have one IL generator. And they have, you know, different sort of symbolic analysis and semantic analysis and lexical analysis and syntactic analysis. But the algorithms that we use for each are very similar, right? So though the VB for loop has its own syntax node and the C# for loop has its own syntax node, they are not the same syntax node. And they have different parsers that produce those syntax nodes. But when we're doing, say, flow analysis, right, where we want to say, okay, is this statement inside this for loop reachable, right? A lot of that code will be shared, right? Basically, we have an agreement on what should the basic data structures look like, what should the basic algorithms look like, how does the parser work, you know, how does error recovery work, how does error reporting work, what's the strategy for distinguishing between things that are declared, right, like classes, and things that are types, like classes, right? You know, there are some things that are declared, like classes have methods. Methods aren't types. Classes are types. Methods have return types. What's the relationship between all of these different things, right? We can come up with some commonalities for those, because we certainly don't want to be in the situation of, we have a compiler as a service for C# and one for VB, and in C#, you know, types inherit from C# type, and in VB, types inherit from symbol, right? I mean, we don't, you know, that are completely separate and have slightly different properties, but essentially represent the same concepts. That was nightmarish for us, right? So we worked very hard to keep the VB and C# code bases in line, even though they are not, strictly speaking, the same code base.
So to switch topics completely, going back to...
Well, that's good, because this is where we're checking in. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. So we talked about your blog in the beginning, mm-hmm, but what is so interesting about your blog is that you've been doing that for a long, long time. And what you usually see with people is that they start a blog and, you know, they're kind of, you know, there's one, two, three, maybe four posts, yes, and then it dies.
Yes.
Whereas you have been doing this for a long time and at a kind of, you know, very regular frequency. So what is your secret, if you want to share that?
it's funny because, again, this has come up several times this week. I'm going to be giving a talk on exactly that topic next week to a bunch of people on this team who want to start blogs, and people ask me that all the time. So first of all, you know, why have I been doing it for so long? Mm-hmm. I enjoy it, right? I really enjoy writing. I really enjoy sharing the stuff that I work on. I get wonderful feedback from it. You know, I get I get to hear from people in our community who are, you know, in the C# and .NET programming community who are involved. I mean, the people who read blogs are, you know, are more involved than the majority of people who don't. These guys have really good ideas for where our product should go. They have really good criticisms. So I enjoy getting all of that feedback. I enjoy answering user questions. You know, I've also been answering questions on Stack Overflow for the last couple of years, which has given me great ideas for the blog, you know.
So what status do you have on Stack Overflow? Are you kind of, you know, one of those people that is like, you know, I don't know, with 100,000 points?
I don't remember what my ranking is, but it's pretty high. I think I'm on the when they list the users, like, they, you know, have like 50 per page or something like that. I think I'm on the first page now.
Nice.
But that's not important, right? I don't care.
There's no kind of sense, a little bit of competition there to kind of, you know.
Some people look at it competitively. My wife studied physical fitness training a couple of years ago, and something that she told me that she learned was people, particularly men, will kill themselves for points. Right? And it's
like
true.
Like Foursquare, yeah.
Yeah.
The whole
badge system. No, I don't really. I'm not motivated by arbitrary points. I am motivated by helping people and by, you know, getting the opportunity to see what problems people are having with the language. Right. You know, it really is a win-win situation. But yeah, something that I've definitely learned about how to have a successful blog is, you know, it does not happen overnight. You know, you've got to be regular, because, you know, nobody likes a blog that's updated, you know, twice a year, right? Or is updated a whole bunch of times and then you wait a long time. No, I've tried to, over the last couple of years, I've tried to keep to a fairly steady cadence of like two posts a week or so. And often what I will do is I will just spend, you know, 4 hours just writing, right? Just writing, you know, these big, long posts, and then split them up into manageable chunks, post them all on a time delay, and not worry about it again for a month.
Nice.
So be regular, be long-lived. Right, because, you know, the if you take a look at the blog stats, which I have access to, but the general public does not, the blogs that are ranked highest on MSDN blogs are the ones that have been there the longest.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Because, you know, they have great content in them, and people start to read them and they don't stop. Right. And have something specific that you want to talk about. You know, people know that if they come to my blog that I'm going to be talking about crazy programming language design corner cases, and not everybody is interested in that stuff, and that's fine, right? My goal is not to have the most popular blog. My goal is to reach the best audience that I can, and that's the audience that's interested in programming languages. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Why don't you blog, Dr. Meyer? I mean, is this your blog?
Yes. Well, that's
not always about you.
No, but that's great, because it shouldn't be about me. It should be about, you know, the great heroes of the company. I did blog in the past, but I find it kind of really hard to kind of, you know, keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And so what I tried is to kind of have like a more technical blog and then a more kind of personal one and a technical one and so on. But yeah, I'm one of those people that, like, you know, after a while, it just, you know, you get too busy with other things, and I'm not disciplined enough. I'm a complete, you know, if you look at my desktop, you know, it's like complete chaos. That's in my mind too, so I don't have any notion of time management or discipline like that. So Channel 9 is for me much better, and then Charles just makes sure that, you know, he schedules the things and I show up. It works great.
It's great. And one of the things about your blog, Eric, and this is one thing I think a lot of people appreciate, is the time that you spend answering questions. So people who are going to invest time in your posts, you give them your time back after the fact, which I think is really, really a very cool thing to do.
Yeah, it's a conversation. Yeah. You know, it's a conversation that, you know, I control.
Yeah.
which is as it should be, mm-hmm. right? You know, the blog has a business purpose, mm-hmm. right? You know, it is for getting information about this product out there, and you know, for having a conversation with the community. I really enjoy writing it, you know, cool. and that's why I've kept at it for this long, just because I write really fast.
Good.
And I haven't run out of things to say yet, and I keep on getting more questions from users every day, so there's plenty of material there.
Totally. And I was laughing at the beginning, Eric, when you were introducing this topic, because I remembered Chris Broom's blog. Yes. Where he'd write these epic posts that are yes. still there that sure. would literally yes. force the browser to block.
Yeah.
Yep. Like you'd sit there and wait for the thing to load, and then you have yes. to read a book. But that was amazing. Of course, he only very blogged useful. For yes. maybe, what, 12, yeah. 15 times? Mm. But the stuff is still useful.
Oh, yes.
But there's no communication going on
yeah.
in the other direction. But that was funny. And he actually got in yep. trouble back in the day because he said a little too much about how he felt, which would bring me to this question. Mm. I mean, you couldn't write a blog like a blog post like, man, I wish I could just write this thing in C++. The hell is C#, man?
Mm.
But you would never do that because, of course, you don't feel that. But that's an example.
Sure.
You have to be smart.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, something that you know, I tell people who want to, you know, be new bloggers at Microsoft is think about what if somebody who was utterly hostile to you and your company decided to take any sentence in there out of context and put it on, you know, /.com or you know, whatever, right? In some forum full of people that was hostile to you. You know, yeah. how would that reflect on you and the company, right? You know, it isn't a perfect company. There are plenty of things that I could criticize about my job or the company or whatever, mm-hmm. and I don't.
Yeah.
Right. Because this isn't the forum for that. Mm-hmm. And you know, something I tell people is like, don't talk about politics, don't talk about religion, don't talk about Microsoft. Mm-hmm. Right. Talk about the work that we do, because we do great work. Right. Mm-hmm. If you talk about the company, then you sound like either you're whining or you've drunk the Kool-Aid. Right, you know that you're just a marketing droid mm-hmm. out to be a booster or an apologist. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, my blog is about the design and implementation of programming languages and other fabulous things. You know, the fact that I work at an enormous multinational software company is mostly incidental to that.
Interesting. Very cool. You do great work.
Yes. All right. Well, I think...
Hey, man. So how do you think this series is going so far? We might as well talk about it.
Well, I'm really enjoying it. It's like, yeah. you know, for me, kind of, you know, eye-opening to talk to, you know, the people that actually built our product.
Yes.
And I think, you know, from what we've seen from the previous episodes, the Niners love it too.
Yep.
So... Yeah, I hope that we can do, we will do many more. With the company is big, so there's plenty of places
we're going to talk to some native people, man.
Also native people, yes.
Because so far it's been all managed, which is yes. a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful yes. thing. And then JavaScript people.
Yes, but also not only about programming languages. We're going across the whole company, right? Every product, we're going everywhere. So
yes, because developers rule this company, man.
Exactly.
All right, cheers.
Thank you.